I was always told that gasoline pumps, lots of germs on those gasoline pumps. Also, be careful when you take your cell phone into the bathroom where you put it. So we're going to talk with Dr. Bill Miller about that, and we'll take your calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Dr. Bill Miller with us. We'll get to your calls. Doctor, in the older days, the ancient days, a couple thousand years ago, did they have all kinds of these viruses and germs running around too?
Absolutely. What is old, what is present today was present in the past, except perhaps for Ebola. I mean, sometimes it's hard to know whether it wasn't there in the past and has left no record. You know, when you look at fossils, one of the reasons why microbes have never been considered important in evolutionary terms up until recently is that when you look at the fossil record, almost always there's no evidence of that microbial companionship or whether or not disease patterns have led to extinctions or things like that. And so paleontologists and others that work in the field, they tend to look at those old bones and they draw the conclusions from what their eyes can see, the seen part of it. But my contention is it's the unseen aspects that have really counted much more than we have ever considered previously. And those in the past we know absolutely from certain fossil specimens that we have seen where there are evidences of prior infectious disease. We know that absolutely.
Who is more apt to come down with disease from germs? Kids, middle-aged adults, older adults?
Actually, the elderly and the very young are, in general, the ones that are most afflicted. That's actually quite a deep question because, you know, George, it really depends on the disease. I don't want it to get too complicated, mm-hmm. but here's an interesting anecdote that I think your listeners might be interested in. So I just finished saying that it's the elderly and the young, and in general that's true. So in any general flu season, it's the elderly whose immune systems are slowly diminishing over time,
yeah.
and the young whose immune systems have not been built up yet that are the most at risk. But here's the thing that most people don't know. There's no memory now of the great pan influenza epidemic of 1918. And maybe a couple of your listeners might know, I've heard about it. This was right in the middle of World War I. It was called the Spanish flu, actually because it was really reported for the first time from Spain, and that's because Spain was one of the few countries that didn't have World War I censorship. But it probably began in the United States. It probably was a swine flu, and it's thought that it may have started in the Midwest, possibly even Nebraska. And because of the troop movements and the fact that this was the first global war and transport was much faster than it had ever been before, different things happened. This flu started and seemed like a regular plain old flu in the beginning of 1918. Then it kind of faded out, and then it began to roar back. And when it came back, it was a much more virulent form, way deadlier than it had been before. And what people don't realize is that a third of the entire population of the world was infected. That's 500 million people back then. And it's hard to know how many people died. The minimum estimate is 20 million.
Jeez.
It may have been, easily have been 50, and some even insist 100 million. But here's the point I'm getting to. It afflicted the robust, the young, the healthy, much more than, I mean, I'm talking about the middle age mm-hmm. and teens, 20s, 30s. The working population was, that age group was affected way more than infants, children, or the elderly, which is the typical flu pattern. So it had a huge consequence on the global scene because there were cities where a large fraction of the workforce was either sick or dead.
That's amazing. And how is it eradicated? Why didn't it just continue to fester and stay?
Well, we really don't know why virulent diseases come and go. You know, that's something that science has to work upon, on and understand much more deeply than we do, but it's absolutely certain that it cycles. It has its own life cycle, and it builds from a small nucleus, it flares, and then it drops away.
Does it die off on its own?
What it does is it dies off on its own, and then it goes back to some sort of a reservoir. The problem with a lot of infectious diseases is that not every single species is infected. So, for example, Ebola is thought to have begun in primates. They're not absolutely certain which one, but there's talk about chimps, possibly. And it isn't clear that Ebola necessarily makes every chimp ill, like it does to humans. It's almost universally fatal among humans. There are animals that are reservoirs. So swine flu, the influenza takes hold in swine, but it's part of it's a place where it can find accommodation, but it doesn't kill it. And when it skips to the next species, then trouble can begin. And it isn't necessarily true that, I mean, it's very idiosyncratic. It's hard to tell which one will be affected and which one won't.
Yeah.
But what I'm getting at is at some point it basically burns out, and it is thought then it retreats back into the, not the benign form, but settles back into the population that does not get clinically ill from it. And it sort of rests there until it chooses its own moment to reappear.
Let's go to some of the calls, and I want to talk with you about the bubonic plague when we come back. Let's go to Fred, driving somewhere in Ohio on the wildcard line. Hey, Fred, go ahead.
Hi, I've just got a couple of comments and a question.
Sure.
First of all, about what you were just now talking about, there's apparently a couple of different games that are available as apps on phones where basically the goal is to infect the world and kill as many people as possible, you know.
Nice.
But it's strangely, I've realized that game, as silly as it may be, might help people to understand how these sorts of things evolve and how they taper off and how we overcome them and whatnot. But I didn't know if you were aware of any of those. But I also wanted to point out that it seems kind of funny to me when people say, well, this is new findings. I've always kind of suspected that there was little universes living on all of the larger creatures, you know, like kind of like a Twilight Zone episode or something. But I was wondering if, say, if one's grandmother perhaps didn't heat and store her food properly when she heated it up for her grandchildren, would that in fact help to evolve some sort of immunity against microbes and such?
Oh, that's a very good question, Fred. First, with respect to these games, I hadn't heard about them before, and they're both interesting and frightening.
Yes.
So, you know, that's how I feel about that.
Huh.
But your
Me
question
too.
About the heating up of the food is a very interesting one because, and I want to keep this clear, part of what's changing in our understanding of evolution is that we used to think that it was always a product of the genes that are inside you, and those stayed pretty much the same. There was a mutation. Well, new discoveries are showing that we are constantly influenced by the impact of genetic material that's coming from microbes at all times of our lives, and that it becomes heritable. It can get passed on from generation to generation. This was part of the theory of a man named Lamarck, who was before Darwin and who was discredited for many, many decades of the modern era and is now coming back into popularity. But my point is that, yes, it is conceivable that what a grandmother does with respect to protecting or exposing their child to infectious disease will change their immunological status. I was talking on another show a couple of days ago, and we were talking about immunology. There's a truth in infectious disease, and all of our exposures to bugs, if it hasn't killed us or permanently hurt us in any way, it has made us stronger immunologically and definitely different immunologically. And so the direct answer to your question is yes, the grandmother's action can affect the heredity of the child.
Interesting. We go to Marcia now in Los Gatos, California, west of the Rockies. Hello, Marcia.
Hello, George and Dr. Bill Miller. Thank you for this opportunity. I love scientists.
Well, thank you.
Me too.
I have a question with a few parts to it. It's in regards to toxoplasmosis, what it is, what the concern about it is, what the microbe that causes it, and how it might be spread. And can someone find out with a, like, antibody titer in their blood to see if they've ever had it?
Well, yes. The answer is this is a very bad microbe. This is not one of the pleasant ones that you really want to become in contact with, but it is generally all over the place. So only some people are susceptible. It's a little bit just like that amoeba stuff that we were talking about before, George. Yep. And so these toxoplasmosis is around us all the time, and only some people get it. And when they get sick from it, it is a devastating thing. So there are titers that can be utilized to go ahead and identify it, and it's definitely something that is best avoided if possible.
Bill, 50 million people died from the bubonic plague, which was caused from infected fleas and small animals. And again, another situation where it seemed to go away after it did its dastardly deed.
Well, it did go away, but it's always there. You know, there are just a couple of instances of plague here in the United States associated with rodents here in the Southwest where I happen to live.
Boy.
But, you know, your point about that prior plague is absolutely fascinating. That plague has had an enormous influence on human history. It wiped out at least one-third of the entire population of Europe and sent it backwards for centuries. There was a persistent problem with the labor pool, and it was absolutely deadly. And fortunately, there are effective antibiotic treatments for
right.
it today. But it will reappear, and sometime in the future, it will be nasty again.
It's a horrible thing. They affected the European labor pool so much they had to raise wages
exactly.
to get people to work. Right?
Well, you know that, George. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. That wasn't the first, the European plague, the one that we know about, was by no means the first or even the most serious. There are actually earlier ones in China, and the Chinese are terrific at record-keeping. And even in the earlier centuries, the 700s, 600s, they have records of devastating, absolutely killer plagues, which are believed to be bubonic plague. And it's a little bit difficult because the features of bubonic plague seem very much like that, but there are other diseases that overlap, one called tularemia, which is generally in rabbits and so on. Anyway, it can be very hard to pin down exactly what the scourge was at the time, but we know that one of the things that will always happen is that we will be able to suppress something and it will come back. The only disease that I know in which it is absolutely at least known to be eradicated is smallpox. And do you know why that is? Vaccination.
Okay. Yeah.
Vaccination denied smallpox enough hosts so that it could not find it's a numbers game. If you can beat the pathogen back through vaccination or other means, and deny it the hosts in which it is required to reproduce, you can actually defeat it. And at the moment, we believe that the only smallpox that exists in the world is highly protected small samples in labs.
As we speak, Bill, the CDC has issued a warning to doctors to be on the alert for bubonic plague.
Oh, I didn't know that. But I do know.
They say there's a heightened risk, and we don't want people to panic, but there's a heightened risk.
Well, fortunately, that risk is at the moment really, really tiny.
Yeah, I guess they're afraid of it spreading. What's the difference between a bacterium, and a virus?
Bacteria and viruses enclose their nuclear materially in totally different ways. Bacteria have a cell wall. Viruses have a capsule, which is a different chemical compound. And their life cycles are different. And the means by which they reproduce are different. Viruses cannot reproduce on their own, and they require the genetic machinery of a cell in order to reproduce.
And much more difficult to kill.
They are extremophiles. They are, it's true, they are capable of survival almost in any circumstance that you can think of. Oh,
yeah.
Here's an interesting thing. So exactly to your point. So we've always thought that we understood the world of microbes pretty well. We would say, oh, that patient's urine is sterile, because they would culture it. And that's, of course, we're finding out that's completely wrong. Every time you urinate, whatever you put out of your body has microbes in it. What was true was that they couldn't culture everything. But we're finding out now that the old culture methods that were used only identified perhaps 1 out of 10 at most of the potential microbial species that were available. And with the new genetic techniques, new means of fractionating samples and looking into them and looking at genetic bits and pieces that are within the sample, they're finding out that there's a vast amount of microbial life in things that were thought to be sterile, like babies. Now, to the point about viruses and how they can survive, they have in NASA things called clean rooms. These clean rooms are where they go ahead and they prepare spacecrafts to go into outer space. They don't want to contaminate space. They don't want to contaminate the moon or Mars or asteroids or comets. And they've, up until recently, all these decades of things that we've sent off to space into the moon, we've declared them sterile based on those old culture techniques. What we know now is we sent out tons of microbes all over the place. We just didn't know we had them there, but we did. We sent them, and I guarantee you, those viruses that you were just mentioning and how hardy they are, we put them. They're on the moon. They're on Mars. We've sent them there.
And flourishing. They're probably growing.
They might or might not be. They may be quiescent, but we don't really know
what
will happen out there.
Bill, we're going to come back in a moment and take final phone calls with you here, and then you can tell us a little bit on where people can track what you do, where we can pick up the microcosm within. We'll be back. Well, next hour, our science advisor, Robert Zimmerman, joins us. We'll talk about some incredible space stories. Make sure you're part of that program. And welcome back, Dr. Bill Miller with us. Bill, where can we get your book, The Microcosm Within?
You can find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, through my publisher, Universal Publishers, and many other web outlets. Or you can go to my website, themicrocosmwithin.com.
Very good. How did you get involved in studying microbes?
Well, actually, this will surprise you. It all began with a girl named Sue. It did. It's because actually,
right,
the girl named Sue I'm talking about is Sue, a Tyrannosaurus rex in the Field Museum in Chicago.
All right.
So I was at a medical meeting, an educational meeting, and I can only sit still for a certain length of time. And after about the third day of the meeting, towards the end of the afternoon, I said, I'm in Chicago. I said, I just can't take it anymore. I was with a friend of mine, a colleague of mine, a partner, and I said, I'm going to either go to the Chicago Art Institute or I'm going to go to the Field Museum. You pick which one we'll go to, but we're getting out of here. So he said, let's go to the Field Museum. So I walk into the Field Museum, and I don't know if you've been there, George, or if some of your listeners may have been there, but there's the rotunda, the entryway. And there is the single best Tyrannosaurus rex specimen in the world, Sue from Montana. And it is towering. It is so impressive. So anyway, I'm going there. I'm standing there next to my partner, and I'm looking at it, and I'm seeing that the ribs look an awful lot like human ribs. I was an imager, and so I understand a lot about anatomy. I'm looking at the vertebrae, and my goodness, those vertebrae are a lot like human vertebrae. That made no sense. And the pelvis shape, that was pretty close, and the hip sockets, very close. And I just stood there in awe and wondering, here's this beast that lived 85 million years ago and existed for 6 million years looking exactly the same. And the thing that really got me, that really sent me over the top was, I'm looking at these little arms. Have you ever seen a Tyrannosaurus?
Oh, yeah, they have little tiny stubby arms.
They're so puny.
Yeah.
But they tell you in Darwinism that it's survival of the fittest, and that organisms will adapt, and they will become better at adaptation in survival, generation by generation, little bit by little bit. And there are these little tiny arms that stayed the same for 6 million years. I just couldn't wrap my mind around it. I said, something is wrong. And that got me into thinking about evolution. But at the same time, I was noticing disease patterns. I'd mentioned earlier on the show that it's very hard for people to think that microbes have any kind of intelligence of any sort. I know most people will just rebel at thinking that that's possible. But it ain't true that they are stupid. They are intelligent within their scope and scale.
And they're survivors.
They have preferences. They can discriminate. They determine what they're going to do. They know how to cooperate. They form little societies of cooperation. And disease patterns, the fact that we can recognize them and make treatment decisions based on certain recognizable patterns of disease, are related to our ability to predict that a certain kind of microbe will do one thing. I said before, one kind of microbe will do pneumonia, Haemophilus influenzae will do pneumonia, and it almost never, ever affects the nervous system, but meningococcal bacteria, they will affect the nervous system. And it's predictable, and we base a treatment on it. So putting those things together got me started down a fantastic road of discovery, and I came to a large number of conclusions that are very different from the standard Darwinian narrative.
I'm glad you did this. Let's go back to the phones. We'll go to Patricia in Roseburg, Oregon. Good morning, Patricia.
Hello, Doctor and George.
Hi, Patricia.
I hope you're having a nice evening.
Yes, we are. Always.
It is a very interesting subject, microbial. I kind of came in when you were talking about the vaccinations, so
yeah.
That's why I called in. And I think it was just to, you know, voice out that, there's a lot of people doing natural medicine now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, keeping clean inside, and now I think more people understand how important it is to make that environment inside, you know, as harmonious as possible, so that when a pathogen does come by, it doesn't stick so harshly. And this is my argument with the, you know, using vaccinations or any kind of attack mechanism.
Well, I think you raise a very good point, Pat. First of all, I don't agree with you with all candor as that is a reason not to be vaccinated. I'm pretty staunch about that, but work with me in another direction, because you and I agree about something deeply, something else that's important for both of us. And you mentioned the concept of harmony, the concept of treating yourself properly so that you are best able to fend off bugs and things like that. And research is proving you to be correct. We are learning that it is a balance of forces. It's almost like Eastern philosophy, but brought to Western medical practice. It's a balance of force. Let me give you a simple example. This just came out the other day. Sleep Research, Sleep Magazine. And the researchers did a study on 164 volunteers, and they were gauging them for how long they sleep, fewer than 6 hours a night or more. And they went to each of these volunteers, and they dropped actual virus loads into their noses. And they found out that those who slept more than 6.5 hours a night had only one quarter of the incidences of infection with that virus than the ones that slept more than 6.5 hours a night. And it was it was startling. And this is just new, just fresh new information. So your point is very well taken.
Are we obsessed with viruses and microbes and keeping places clean?
Yes. I think that we've gotten to the point where, again, it's everything's a cycle, and things come in and out of fashion all the time. You know, white socks are good and white socks are bad, and I don't mean to dismiss microbes at all, but we've become very, very, very concerned to the point where we are not letting our children, in particular, experience as much microbial interaction as would do them good, and would probably do us good too.
Next up, we go to Todd, first-time caller, Old Town, Florida. Welcome to the program, Todd.
Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. And I think we can all safely assume that Tyrannosaurus Rex would not have made a world-class boxer.
Not at all.
That's very funny.
Other than that, gentlemen, I joined the military in 1979. I watched a good friend of mine die from these vaccines that Dr. Miller seems to be so in love with. And I was vaccine damaged for over 25 years with the most horrible side effects you can imagine. Thank God I finally got over it back in 05. But you mentioned the measles. Doctor, you are spreading disinformation about this. You said, oh, it's deadly. Statistics show that in the past 10 years, measles in the United States has killed one person. That vaccine that you're so in love with has killed over 100, doctor. You don't know what you're talking about. I don't even think you're a doctor.
Well, he's a doctor. But, Bill, go ahead.
Well, I really know that you're completely wrong, to put it very bluntly. Measles is currently not a deadly disease. But if you would, and I urge you, just go to the Internet. Don't believe me. Just go to the Internet and look up the history of measles, and you will learn that it is, throughout the history of humanity, one of the great scourges. We are privileged and very lucky to have a measles that is of an attenuated form, which is in part due to universal vaccination. And so I just simply disagree with you respectfully, but I do disagree with you and urge you, instead of simply believing what I say right now, just go right to the Internet, go to Wikipedia or some other source, and learn about measles, vaccination, and some of these other things.
Now, he's probably right about 100 people dying from bad vaccines. I mean, I'm sure that happens.
I don't believe that that is known to be true. Right now, the government has a program that actually reimburses people quite generously if they can claim and validate problems with vaccination. And please, let me emphasize, I'm not saying that vaccination is absolutely without risk. I'm not saying that at all. I'm simply saying that it is a balance between risk and benefit, and that it is a balance that is wildly in favor of vaccination compared to risk. That doesn't mean it is without any risk. But with respect to this particular fund, if you examine the records of the outlays of those funds, these are the people that come to the government and claim, because there's a big vaccination fund pool of money, they make the claim. The biggest claim for vaccination injury is administration of the vaccination, muscle problems, claims of nerve damage from improper placement of the vaccine when someone goes and gets vaccinated, Again, people can just look this up on the web. They can take my word for it or do their own research, and they'll see that what I'm saying is true.
One of the things about the internet that is not positive is that it does spread myths about certain stories, and then a lot of people have a difficulty trying to find out if it's true or not.
Exactly. But there are reliable sources. Something like Wikipedia is a fine source. It gets pretty well scrutinized. There's WebMD. There are plenty of scrupulous sites that are available for those people that are fair-minded and want to look into this and form their own opinion based on gathering some evidence that it can be offered to them.
Are you a doctor, Bill?
Oh, of course I'm a doctor. Yes, very definitely.
Well, let's go to Jim, truck driving in Arizona on the wild card line. Jim, go ahead, sir.
Hey there, guys, George and Dr. Bill.
Hi there.
Hey, how are you?
Quick story and then a follow-up in regards to the story. My wife is Nicaraguan, so we go to Nicaragua, or we used to. So, of course, the first time, like normally anybody goes to a new country, I got sick for 24 hours, getting used to the food.
Oh, yeah.
But in 2013, this is like my fourth trip, when I came back, within 30 days, I was sick and I had to go to the hospital, which... that would be the first time I would ever have to go to the hospital. That was my first medical record ever documented, was in 2013. They determined when I went to the emergency room, when they found out where I was from, or where I just came from in Nicaragua, that at that time there was two outbreaks of dengue fever and malaria that was my wife's mom is actually a head doctor there for DNA testing just for that outbreak that was going on. And she was telling me that, as well as letting the doctors there know, that the death rate in Nicaragua for just those two diseases was 8 out of 10. So it was pretty severe. So they tested me for that, and it was negative, which is a good thing. But I was deathly sick.
Yeah.
They found two things wrong with me. One was a super pneumonia, and then there was something else that was foreign. They had no idea what it was. They tried helping me, and after a while, they said nothing that we can do. I started getting better on my own. I was in the hospital for 9 days, and I'm getting released. But they did tell me that the damage that was done to my lungs would take a minimum of 8 months to heal, if they would heal at all. And then I found out, because I overheard them in the hospital talking, because they actually called in the CDC representative from Atlanta. He says, well, I got to get a CDC guy from Africa, and they flew him in, and they flew a woman doctor, CDC, that was in Nicaragua. They flew her in because that's where I came from. Again, they had no idea what it was. They could see it, but they didn't know what it was. So they actually, I heard overheard them saying that they're putting me on a CDC watch list. I had no idea what that is, and that was going to be my question. But to finish up the story, after 14 days after I left the hospital, my lungs were completely healed. They could not believe it. They did CAT scans, x-rays, the whole shebang, and they were like, your lungs are completely back to normal. We're not sure how that's possible, but you are on a CDC watch list, so we have to take your blood every month. And then after the third month, they said, well, you're fine, so now we're just going to take your blood every 6 months, but you're still remaining on a CDC watch list. So I was curious if you could explain the CDC watch list and what it is and how it functions.
Well, I'm no expert on the CDC watch list. I can tell you that your story is absolutely remarkable. I wonder if you didn't have some kind of a very rare parasite, and somehow your immune system was strong enough to overcome it. It's very unusual. I really don't know enough about the CDC watch list to offer you additional background, but I do want to make a comment about your experience. You mentioned dengue fever and malaria, and one of the things that is going to be of continuing concern is that the spread of infectious disease in a world of an era of global travel is different than it had been in the past. We had a good example of that with Ebola.
Yeah, and the CDC has people on an Ebola watch list.
Exactly. Under that circumstance, when it's a severe enough circumstance, they actually have to report in or stay confined. But that's not what this gentleman is talking about. The thing is that one of the consequences of climate change no matter if it's real or, I mean, if it's man-induced or not. I don't want to take any sides about climate change, except to say that the one certainty of a changing climate, no matter its cause and no matter when it happens, is going to be a change in the pattern of infectious disease. We're seeing changes now, and I'm not saying that it's due to the climate change kind of discussion that is going on, that it's man-induced, but we know that there's a shifting pattern of malaria. We know that West Nile virus is shifting in its pattern. We know that with global travel, chikungunya, which was a very little-known infectious disease confined to the western part of Africa, has spread to the Caribbean, and as now there have been hundreds of cases in the continental United States. And so we need to learn a great deal more about infectious disease and novel pathogens, just like this gentleman may have suffered, because in an era of global travel, it can affect us in a way that it couldn't have centuries before. And that's where I think the bulk of money for climate change issues should go. Instead of expensive remediation projects where we're going to capture carbon and throw them in the ground and carbon credits and all this stuff, the final common denominator of any shift in climate, the way that it will impact human beings most, will be through a shifting pattern of infectious disease. And if we would spend those research dollars, that money, as research into how to protect populations from significant pathogens, we get a lot more bang for the buck than we're going to do with some of these other programs.
All right, Bill, I want to thank you for being on the program, and let's stay in touch. I'd like to use you as a resource every once in a while.
I'd be privileged. Thanks very much. Okay. I've really enjoyed it.
Dr. Bill Miller, his book, The Microcosm Within. Up next, our science advisor, Bob Zimmerman, joins us, all things space.